than the city. Apart from Hong Kong, the world's two economic powers are at odds over other issues, including Taiwan and the South China Sea. Despite repeated warnings, the U.S. Navy on Thursday announced the sailing of a warship through the Taiwan Strait, claiming it was a routine transit of the USS John Finn. It was the third such voyage through waters separating mainland China and Taiwan since President Joe Biden took office. Still, China has called on the U.S. to bring the bilateral relations back on the right track through objective and rational mechanism. It also called on the U.S. to stop interfering in China's internal affairs. The call followed a series of rhetoric by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who alleged that China is a challenge to the security and values of Washington and its allies. American and Chinese officials are scheduled to hold a cliffhanger meeting next week in Alaska, which will be the first diplomatic overture since Biden entered the White House. The outcome might improve or worsen the already tense relations between the two.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has denounced the policies of the United States. In his speech marking the occasion of Eid al-Mab'ath, Ayatollah Khamenei slammed Washington for building military bases in the region under the pretext of fighting terrorism and called for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq and Syria. Ayatollah Khamenei said Washington is the only country that has used nuclear weapons in action, but it claims to be against weapons of mass destruction. He noted that Washington still has the biggest nuclear arsenal in the world. Iran's leader also accused Washington of turning a blind eye as its Arab allies keep bombarding civilians in Yemen. He pointed out that Washington and even the United Nations, however, raised an outcry as soon as the people of Yemen started defending themselves against the Saudi-led aggressors. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said the United States is inverting the truth by claiming to support human rights while supporting those who violate them. Washington's double standards were also highlighted in remarks made by Iran's foreign minister. In a tweet, Mohammad Javad Zarif said the new U.S. administration is still sticking to a policy of maximum pressure against Iran, but claims to favor diplomacy. Zarif also denounced Washington's move to block the release of Iranian assets frozen in South Korea. He noted that Iran needs the fund to purchase food and medicine as the country is fighting to contain the spread of the new coronavirus. Iran's foreign minister made the comments after U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced Washington's opposition to unfreezing of the Iranian funds by South Korea. Blinken said the money will only be released when Iran returns to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. Tehran, however, says it will only reverse its commitment cuts once Washington removes all its unilateral sanctions against the Islamic Republic. Iranian officials argue it was the U.S. that threw the agreement into crisis by its withdrawal and must therefore be the one who returns to it first. On the surface, it looks like the new administration in the White House has chosen to adopt less hawkish policies and engage more with the world. But in reality, little has changed since Joe Biden took the helm in January. Eyes are now on the Biden administration to see whether Washington will choose to give up its bullying or keep on the same beaten track.
Crude oil is considered one of the backbones of the Indian economy, and recent months have seen a sharp rise in the crude prices. Petrol prices are at an all-time high in the state of Mumbai, while diesel, the main driver of industrial activity, is being sold for more than 88 rupees a liter, raising transportation costs. The government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi for now has shifted the blame for high prices on previous governments and production cuts by some oil exporting nations.
Experts say the rising crude prices will put pressure on the country's economy that's heavily dependent on imports and has just recovered from a deep recession following COVID-19 pandemic, which shattered the world economy.
While many experts believe that the government could cut taxes on petrol and diesel ahead of election in five key states, they, however, warn that the persistent higher prices could lead to inflation, which could threaten the path to recovery. They say both state and central government should act swiftly.
Prices are at historic high. Now, both the state governments and the central governments they both will have to jointly come with reduction. Now, state governments have their own issues, and they, despite the fact that all the opposition parties, they are trying to make out a case for reduction, but they are not acting.
While the revenues gained from taxes on retail fuel is key for government to boost spending in the economy that exited a rare recession, the central bank sees those levies along with elevated crude prices a benefit. But experts say any withdrawal of the easy monetary policies to combat price growth will lead to a spike in borrowing costs, in turn hurting consumption and business activity at a time when millions of Indians are still out of work due to pandemic. Experts say the turmoil in West Asia is also a factor driving oil prices, especially for India, which is import-driven economy. Meanwhile, a new report by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development predicts India will be among the large economies most severely hit by the COVID-19 pandemic and the lockdown restrictions to combat it. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Spring is about to kick in, and nations that celebrate Nowruz are gearing up to ring in the Persian New Year. Gathering in Tehran is attended by representatives from all countries that mark the ancient tradition of Nowruz, including Iran, Afghanistan, and Tajikistan. They're here to exchange views on the history of the long-standing festivity and share their unique customs in celebrating the occasion.
The Nowruz festival in Tajikistan starts with a nationwide ceremony called Golgardani, where children who carry flowers go door to door and share the flowers with different families.
Every year during Nowruz, we take part in the Roses Festival, which is hosted by the city of Mazar-e Sharif, and people from all over the country gather there to celebrate.
During the Roses Festival in Afghanistan, we have a special performance called Molla Muhammad Jan, which is an exciting love story.
Nowruz means new day in Persian, and it marks the first day of spring in the Northern Hemisphere. To Iranians, it translates into a time to refresh the soul from all bad memories and make a fresh start in the year ahead.
In Iran, days ahead of Nowruz, all Iranians do the spring cleaning tradition. But what is more is the fact that not only do we dust off our houses, but we also purify our minds and our souls from any bad experiences. That's why Nowruz is regarded as a festival of peace, when nations come together and celebrate far from any political considerations.
Nowruz is now a recognized tradition in the world. In 2009, the United Nations proclaimed Nowruz an international event at the initiative of 12 countries that shared this event, including Iran, Afghanistan, India, and Turkey. Nowruz has been celebrated by Iranians since 3 millennia ago. This year, mass celebrations will largely be limited in the wake of the coronavirus. But that's what Nowruz is all about. Throw away bad thoughts, and let's hope that in the Persian New Year, the virus will leave us alone. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
What once caught in the hundreds of children who remained in the border patrol hands when they were cruelly separated from their parents by the Donald Trump regime, now they are counted by the thousands. The number tripled in just a few weeks. According to the internal CBP report, there are more than 3,400 unaccompanied migrant children in cages.
It might be a big problem in the immediate future, like meaning in this couple of months ahead of us. But it's certainly not the main headache as it relates to immigration, because as we know, the problem is much more complex, and it's a problem that he inherited, not from the precisely from the Trump administration, but from years of a broken system that has not been fixed.
What is happening on the United States border was ignored for several days by President Biden's administration, even publicly refusing to accept that they are facing a humanitarian crisis. Still, according to witnesses, this is how they address the issue internally.
It is a humanitarian crisis because every time we deal with groups that migrate and you are not able to accommodate them, the numbers, the volume, it becomes a humanitarian crisis by definition of what a crisis is. However, if we hear carefully, the Biden administration is not labeling a crisis. The word crisis is coming from the conservative, the Republican Party, because the more you label it a crisis, it will give more ammunition from the right to say, you can't solve it.
Aside from being detention cages that is not designed for children, a report indicates that they are sleeping on benches as there are no beds. According to government data, 9,000 migrant children crossed the border in February, but now thousands more are waiting on the Mexican side. Reporting from Miami, Ronnie Carvello.
The sixth conference of American human rights was held near the Turkish city of Istanbul to discuss the violations of human rights by the United States and the region. The participants stressed that preserving unity among the Islamic world is a must in standing against the U.S. and its Western allies' policies, which have only brought death and war to the region.
In this conference, we have tried to discuss the human rights from the point of view of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, as well as the scholars of other countries, including Turkey.
The participants also expressed concerns over the crimes being committed by the U.S. and its Western allies in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, saying the U.S. must be held accountable for the human rights violations.
The conference seeks to introduce the crimes committed by the United States to the international community and the young generation.
The speaker said Iran and Turkey must stand together to stop the U.S. interventions in the region.
The U.S. boasts about defending human rights, but it is the main violator of the rights in the world, particularly in our region. We are here today to show the real face of the U.S. as the main country behind genocides underway in the region.
Unity is the key to preserve Muslim nation against foreign interferences. This has been the main theme of the conference this year. The Iranian and Turkish scholars called for vigilance among regional states to stop the U.S. violence and put an end to its plots in the region. Rahshan Saglam, SN Yurt.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Mm-hmm.
the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need, which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, as both the U.S. and the U.K. Talk about non-proliferation for other countries, both of them plan on improving their nuclear warheads. A report by The Guardian says there will be an increase in the number of warheads that the U.K. possesses. Meanwhile, Washington is reportedly going ahead with a massive $100 billion program to upgrade and modernize its nuclear missiles, this coming from the only country which has ever used nuclear weapons against a civilian population, the United States.
For the first time since the end of the Cold War, the United Kingdom is planning on increasing its stockpile of nuclear warheads. A report by The Guardian says a review of defense and foreign policy would see an increase of the number of warheads, which currently stands at 180. The review is set to be released next week. The last defense review in 2015 committed the UK to reducing the number of operationally available warheads to 120. The increase is said to be aimed at persuading the US to co-fund a replacement for UK nuclear weapons, also known as a Trident nuclear program. Britain has been heavily dependent on US technology to operate its nuclear weapons in the past 60 years. Observers believe Britain wants to convey to Washington that the UK is still part of the US hegemonic apparatus.
This is a desperate attempt to shore up Britain's fading prestige on the world stage as a major power and trying to prove to Washington that it is still part of Washington's hegemonic apparatus and is still a valued partner. It is no secret that the Biden administration looks poorly on Brexit, and this is a desperate attempt, as I say, to compensate for the ravages of Brexit.
The United Kingdom is not the only country looking to expand its nuclear arsenal. Just days ago, reports came out that the United States, which already possesses nearly 6,000 warheads, is also planning on building a new nuclear missile worth $100 billion. The Federation of American Scientists says that this plan is being driven by intense industry lobbying rather than a clear assessment of the purpose of the new intercontinental ballistic missile. This is while the Biden administration is gearing up for the first defense budget, which may reveal its intentions as regards the nuclear missile. Also, Israel is believed to possess hundreds of nuclear warheads, though it has never openly acknowledged it. Tel Aviv has always turned a deaf ear to international calls for nuclear transparency. With the support of the United States and other Western countries, the occupying regime has even refused to join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Both the United States and the UK are signatories to the NPT. As parties to the treaty, they have pledged not to acquire or exercise control over nuclear weapons or receive assistance in the manufacture of such devices. The Western states' possession of such nuclear arsenal raises the question as to why they are pressuring other countries like Iran not to develop nuclear capabilities for civilian purposes. This is while multiple reports by the International Atomic Energy Agency have verified the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program. All in all, with the U.S. being the only country that has used nuclear weapons against another nation and its massive use of depleted uranium weapons at civilian areas in Iraq and Syria, one would argue the legitimacy of the West to possess nuclear weapons.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this debate from the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament and Stop the War Coalition, Jim Brann, out of London, and co-director of International Action Center, Sarah Flanders, out of New York. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off in London. And Jim, why do you think that the UK is planning to increase the number of its nuclear warheads, especially when the country is going through such a major economic pressure? Why now?
Well, I'm surprised that it's actually planning to increase the number of warheads. So that came as news to me. But the general line that Britain is increasing its military spending, for example, there was a surprise announcement about 3 or 4 months ago that came completely out of the blue, where Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced an extra £16 billion for so-called defense spending. On top of the regular budget, and that's consistent with a whole trend in recent years. And for example, this year in a couple of months' time, they're going to be sending a British aircraft carrier, one of these brand new aircraft carriers, to the Pacific, and it's interesting to note that it will be escorted by a United States warship, and it will carry on it, the aircraft carrier will carry on it, half its complement will be from the United States Marine Corps Air Force. So that shows you the extent to which Britain is dependent, even for its so-called independent aircraft carrier, on the United States, and needs to come under the wing of the United States if it's to follow its trajectory for the last, basically since the end of the Second World War. And its nuclear policy fits in with that. So in general, it's not a surprise, although I am shocked they're actually going to increase the number of warheads. As far as the money goes, I'm afraid there seems to be no object.
Let me try to get Sarah in on this conversation. The U.S. is also in the middle of a pandemic and major economic strain. Under the Trump administration, announced the increase of $100 billion upgrade to its nuclear weapons. Why is that the case? Why is that a priority in your perspective?
The U.S. military budget is an enormous, spectacular, multi-billion-dollar subsidy to the largest U.S. corporations. And every single year, under both Republican and Democratic administrations, the U.S. defense budget grows 3 to 5%, and always with a new excuse of modernizing weapons, whether it's aircraft carriers, jet aircraft, nuclear weapons, and it's intense lobbying among the different major defense contractors. Now, the Biden administration, their top appointees come directly from the top defense lobbying corporations, the West Exec Advisors, the Pine Island Capital Partners. These are defense lobbyists, and that's where General Austin, retired General Austin, and Blinken, Secretary of State, come directly from. So, yes, they want to increase the budget because nothing else right now in the U.S. is making money. So this is guaranteed profit. It puts the whole world at risk. It's complete hypocrisy that this is needed for defense. Of course, it would end life on this planet. And it's a completely insane and yet profitable. That is what drives it. And it is what is driving Britain right now as a junior partner of the U.S., having cut ties with Brexit. Where are they going to go in the world except to be the junior partner tagging along and also bankrupting the people of Britain, the working people? Just like the working people here who desperately, desperately need help. And instead, it's going to a huge new handout, modernizing nuclear weapons. What an outrage to the entire world.
Jim, why do you think we not hear an outcry from international agencies such as NPT or International Atomic Energy Agency about these proposed upgrades? These weapons of mass destruction by the U.S. and the U.K.?
You cannot find a more consistent example of complete hypocrisy on the part of the nuclear powers regarding the question of nuclear weapons. You can't do it. For example, we are now 75 years since the first meeting of the United Nations General Assembly, which occurred in London, in a bomb-ravaged London, 5 months after the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the United Nations General Assembly met in London before any other institution of the United Nations had been established. There was no General Secretary, the Security Council hadn't been convened. The UN General Assembly met in London, and resolution number one the United Nations General Assembly of January 1946 was concerning the abolition of nuclear weapons. And October that year, a few months later, British Cabinet Committee met in secret and decided to go ahead with building a British atomic bomb for reasons of British power, and explained that there was no other reason for it. And also relations with the United States. that's how things have remained for 75 years. Last month, January this year, the nuclear ban treaty came into effect. And that's the vast majority of the world backing the abolition of nuclear weapons, the call of 75 years ago that nuclear weapons must be abolished. So there's total hypocrisy. You can't find any stand of US, Britain, and to a different extent other nuclear powers. You can't find anything but hypocrisy. Nothing makes sense. Unless you understand that nuclear weapons are a weapon of blackmail. They're not a weapon of defense, they're not a weapon of deterrence. They're a weapon of big power blackmail with the supposed right to blow the world up.
What about that, Sarah? You heard what our guest in London said. There's nothing more hypocritical than the way these countries and also so-called international agencies respond in dealing with nuclear weapons or nuclear proliferation. Your take on that, and why do you think that is the case? Because we see a vast difference in the way some countries are treated. We're talking about UK and US tonight. And then on the other hand, we have a country such as Iran with a peaceful nuclear program that is treated totally opposite on the other end of the spectrum.
Well, I couldn't agree more. It is absolute hypocrisy. The U.S. threatens the world with first strike nuclear weapons, including countries that have no nuclear defense. And it is the greatest hypocrisy, the charges against Iran developing nuclear energy, and for that, sanctioning Iran. Now, the sanctions against Iran predate Iran developing any form of nuclear energy. The sanctions on Iran have always been an effort to regain U.S. control and domination of Iran, has no other purpose. And even tacking on Iran developing nuclear energy, as if that's a great threat, it's a very important part of modern industrialization, and charging that that's a nuclear weapon, while this building of nuclear weapons continues unabated. Modernization, new generation, the nuclear weapons of Israel, the nuclear weapons of the surrounding countries. It's complete hypocrisy. Everyone understands it, but the U.S. is a big threat. So, of course, international and U.N. agencies go along with what is a total charade in the most outrageous, really, way, and a complete this is a theft of world resources on a huge scale. When you're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars, and I want to say the whole defense budget in the U.S., not only nuclear weapons, is enormous, enormous theft of resources. They'll spend, yes, almost $2 trillion in 30 years' time on nuclear weapons. But they'll spend in 2 years that on the defense budget, which is all kinds of other weapons all thrown in. Different corporations are vying for the contracts, and that's what you see being played out in the media. But none of them want to let go of these guaranteed profits. And that is what it's about. It is about profits, a direct subsidy from the U.S. government, from the British government, to big contractors. It's not about anything else. Mm. And it's certainly not about peace. It's not about ending nuclear weapons. It's about more weapons.
Well, how dangerous is that, Sarah? It's profit. You just said profit. So profit over people's lives. I mean, where do we stand with that? It's as if these entities are basically rogue states and will do whatever they want at any time because of the dollar.
They are rogue. Yes. They are rogue states. They're rogue states to their own population. Here is the U.S. with the highest COVID infection and death rate in the world. And the U.S. and Britain are neck and neck in terms of percentage of the population suffering infection and death. And yet they have billions to spend on direct handouts to the biggest corporations. Yet for the population itself, is there the tracking? Is there the tracing? Is there the vaccines available? Is there the health care available? There's simply not. Mm-hmm. Is there the public medicine available? There's absolutely not. And they stand there acting like they're helpless. Or in Congress today, you see, okay, this is great, a $1.9 trillion package of economic relief. Most of it, again, goes to the corporations. A tiny fraction goes to working people. A little tiny handout that would pay less than 2 months of rent.
Right.
So this is all hypocrisy on another level, but it is intended to get this through quietly, all by sleight of hand. You'll see a whole series of articles about why this or that weapon needs to be modernized and is part of defense. It's defense of profit. It's not defense of the population here.
Okay. Let me get Jim back in on this. Jim, you know, Sarah had talked about, when we talked about international agencies, that basically because the U.S. is powerful, that these other countries are intimidated and go along with the U.S. I wanted your perspective on that. Is it that they are intimidated, or basically have these international agencies, they've been set up in a way that they're actually less international than more U.S. or Western controlled to begin with?
Yes, I'll give you one, I think, example that's very relevant to what you mentioned earlier. We are now 40 years, I think it's this very month, we are 40 years since Israel bombed an Iraqi nuclear reactor, which Iraq had bought from France, and had actually supplied to Israel itself, the same basic reactor it supplied to Israel earlier, but it also supplied it to Iraq. And 40 years ago, Israel said, well, if Iraq develops nuclear technology through this nuclear reactor, it wasn't inherently military, it's just a nuclear reactor, then Iraq will have the capacity or increased capacity to go for a nuclear weapons program. So Israel bombed it. And that was a gross, blatant violation of everything that was agreed, especially in 1945 with the conclusion of the Second World War and the setting up of the United Nations and so on. And it's interesting to note that the United Nations Security Council met very quickly after the Israeli bombing and condemned it and said it was a gross violation of the basis of international law and called upon Israel to join the treaties, the NPT, and I think also the International Atomic Energy Agency. And that's how the resolution stood. On the face of it, it looks absolutely clear-cut.
But actually, at the end, nothing really happens.
If I could just finish it. It mandated the Secretary General of the United Nations to report, I think it's every three months, to the United Nations Security Council on the implementation of the resolution. And if anybody wants to do an absurd play, to write it an absurd play, it will consist of the character representing the UN Secretary General going to the UN Security Council every 3 months for 40 years and reporting no progress. That's how they set it up. So you're absolutely right. You have a condemnation by the UN Security Council, unanimous condemnation, and then complete toothlessness, because that's how they wrote the resolution.
Sarah, I'm sorry, Jen, let me just get Sarah in on this because we're just about out of time. But Sarah, what does it all mean? If on the one hand, as you've talked about, the massive hypocrisy that we see coming from these entities that have nuclear weapons and even condemning countries that are trying to have a peaceful nuclear program, and then the international entities that have been allegedly set up to balance things are actually under the control of those same countries. So where is all this going? What is the answer to this, Sarah, in your perspective?
I think to place no confidence in the international agencies that are supposedly monitoring this, and no confidence in, I think we should call on UN past resolutions to be respected, but not believe that they will be respected. It's more and more important than ever that the people in the U.S., in Britain, in the countries around the world make their own demands on governments that refuse to listen and just refuse to buy into the idea that this has anything to do with defense. The defense contractors, they're called defense, they have nothing to do, as I say, with defense, but Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Northrop, Raytheon, they don't produce anything that people need. They produce a death machine. And it is a death machine that is bankrupting the U.S. and the world. It is a huge theft of resources, and it is pulling actually the U.S. and Britain down. The position Britain is in, the U.S. is very close to. It is a decaying empire with unfunctional infrastructure right here, not only in health, but in basic roads and bridges and buildings. Complete deterioration, and all the money is getting pumped into defense.
Okay.
And right here, we become sicker. So I think it's a more important time than ever for people here to speak out for peace, but consciously against the theft of the resources by these corporations.
Okay. And on that note, so sorry to end it, but we're out of time. Appreciate both of you being with us from the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, Jim Brand out of London, and co-director of International Action, Senator Sarah Flanders out of New York. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. To our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight.
A new book, Poisoning the Pacific, examines the U.S. military's long role in the environmental degradation of East Asia and Pacific Islands, severely impacting the health of the region's people and U.S. personnel stationed there. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by John Range, author. This article is published under the heading U.S. military exposed 600,000 to toxins in Japan and Micronesia and hid it. Here's more. A new book, Poisoning the Pacific, examines the U.S. military's long role in the environmental degradation of East Asia and Pacific Islands, severely impacting the health of the region's people and U.S. personnel stationed there. Author John Mitchell is a Tokyo-based journalist, and much of his book focuses on Japan, especially its southernmost prefecture of Okinawa. But he also covers contamination in places like Vietnam, Guam, and the Marshall Islands. The hazards range from nuclear fallout to the chemical weapons sarin and VX to PFAS, a class of potentially carcinogenic forever chemicals, so-called because once in the body or environment, they remain for a long time. The U.S. military and supporting government agencies have long prioritized public relations over mitigating harm. When an accidental spill exposed Okinawan-based workers to lead, cadmium, and hexavalent chromium in 1975, the U.S. consulate cabled the State Department, urging the U.S. to prepare the best possible political posture in the event of future pollution accidents. Handbooks issued on marines from 2013 to 2015 barred them from informing Japanese officials of potentially and politically sensitive incidents. While detailing the environmental catastrophes the U.S. military inflicts on these places, Mitchell also lays out its efforts to cover them up. Among its many techniques, the crudest is outright lying. In 1965, Marines training in Okinawa let CS gas, a tear gas component, drift into a nearby middle school, causing students to suffer throat pain and difficulty breathing. The Marines, however, told teachers their pupils must have inhaled gun smoke. Then there is secrecy. In 1986, Congress's General Accounting Office produced a report on hazardous waste management problems at overseas bases. Such reports are normally made public, but the Defense Department insisted that this one be classified. In Japan, intergovernmental matters involving U.S. bases are handled by the U.S.-Japan Joint Committee, which acts, Michel writes, in total secrecy with zero public oversight. In 2000, the committee collaborated on a joint statement of environmental principles. The final product declared that the U.S. would remedy any U.S. military-caused contamination posing a known imminent and substantial threat to human health. Here was one of the subtler deceptions, as all three conditions are vague and disputable. Imminent, for example, excludes toxins that accumulate in the body over time. One of the U.S. military's hurriest cover-up methods is smearing critics as anti-American or anti-military. In 1954, a U.S. nuclear test irradiated a Japanese fishing boat. Crew members were sickened, and one died within months. Understandably, people were upset, but the U.S. ambassador to Japan called those who spoke out neutralists, pacifists, feminists, and professional anti-Americans. Ultimately, 32 million Japanese people signed a petition to ban thermonuclear weapons. There is a lot of professional anti-Americans. In 1990, the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs spoke darkly of anti-military hidden agendas behind environmental policies. But the epithet anti-military might better apply to those who conceal the harm to U.S. personnel and deny them treatment. For example, in late 1970s, when the Pentagon sent service members to clean up Enewak Atoll, severely contaminated from U.S. nuclear tests, it failed to provide them with hazmat suits or respirators, while assuring Congress otherwise. To keep up the pretense, when journalists visited the cleanup site, soldiers were given full-body safety equipment and posed for the cameras. the only time most of the men saw such gear during their time on the island, writes Mitchell. And in 2013, when barrels containing dioxin, a contaminant produced in the manufacture of military herbicides, were unearthed on land formerly part of Kanina Air Base in Okinawa, base leadership assured service members that aside from the skin disease, chloroquine, no other human health effects have been proven. The Environmental Protection Agency begs to differ. Dioxins are highly toxic and can cause cancer, reproductive and developmental problems, damage to the immune system, and can interfere with hormones. The barrels were found under a children's soccer field, adjacent to schools attended by children of U.S. personnel. Another weapon in the military's armory is to site its bases and testing in U.S. territories and other places with limited sovereignty, enabling it to ignore the rights of the people there. After the Second World War, the United Nations granted the U.S. trusteeship of Marshall Islands. Within months, the U.S. was using the territory as a nuclear weapons test site. Several years later, seeking locations for deploying those weapons, the U.S. chose Okinawa, which it ruled by fiat until 1972. Even now, U.S.-backed conservative governments in Tokyo routinely side with the Pentagon over their own citizens in Okinawa, effectively granting it vast sway over public health. As a reporter, Mitchell has personally encountered obfuscation, having been spied on and blocked from accessing public U.S. military websites. In 2016, an American university's Tokyo campus invited him to speak about Okinawa's environmental degradation. The State Department taught the school's U.S. headquarters into ordering the Tokyo branch to schedule a separate lecture for a U.S. embassy official. In the end, however, the embassy canceled its talk, claiming staff were too busy. Via a Freedom of Information Act request, Mitchell eventually learned the real reason for the cancellation. An embassy official had warned, "This sounds like a death trap." That is, they realized that if U.S. personnel with health concerns showed up, as they had to Mitchell's talk, it would be a PR disaster. The U.S. military's pattern of deceit extends beyond the period covered in the book. On April 10, 2020, a barbecue party held by U.S. Marines in a hangar on Futenma Air Base in Okinawa triggered the release of firefighting foam. No one present knew how to turn it off, and 38,000 gallons spilled outside the base. The foam contained one of the PFAS forever chemicals and contaminated such places as children's playground. Okinawa Prefecture requested soil samples to check for contaminants, and on May 1st, officials were finally allowed on base to receive some. A week earlier, though, the Marines had excavated the same area in order to remove all possible contaminants. Thus, they provided soil samples only after ensuring they would be useless. When prefectural officials requested samples from other areas, the Marines initially refused, relenting only on May 11th, over a month after the incident, when they provided additional samples. But as usual, there were conditions. While Okinawa wished to analyze four constituents, it was allowed to analyze only two. In sum, the U.S. military has exposed 600,000 people, including Americans, to toxins in Japan and Micronesia, according to Mitchell's very conservative estimate.
Good morning.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.